Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. The government shutdown continues into its fifth week. The president, though, made a new offer in a Saturday night speech. So far, Democrats say they're unimpressed. So let's listen to a little bit of what they had to say. First, here's the president, then followed by Virginia Democrat Senator Mark Warner.
I am here today to break the logjam and provide Congress with a path forward to end the government shutdown.
What the president proposed yesterday, I'll use that as a starting point, but you've got to start by opening the government.
A starting point, maybe, but not any real progress forward. Well, former senator, former Senate Majority Leader, and former Northern Ireland Special Peace Envoy George Mitchell knows what it's like to deal with intractable conflicts, where the parties are dug in and sworn to fight until victory. So who better to listen to today than he? This hour On Point, Senator George Mitchell and the search for a way out of this government shutdown. And you can join us. Did you see any movement this weekend when the president spoke from the White House and offered his new plan? Or do you think that there was nothing new in it? Do you think that Democrats responded in the right way? Could Congress and the president use a mediator now? Maybe someone like Senator Mitchell. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And Senator George Mitchell will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. But first, we want to get the latest on the shutdown and the political impasse in Washington. So joining us is Gabby Orr. She covers the White House for Politico. Gabby, welcome to the program.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so first of all, give us a little update as of today. Is there any progress, any further reaction from Democrats to what the president offered in his 13-minute speech he gave from the White House this weekend?
Well, what we've heard over the weekend since the president delivered those remarks, offered up that latest proposal, is basically near uniformity on both sides. Democrats are saying that they won't negotiate until the government is reopened, and essentially that the offer that the president made on Saturday is sort of a combination of already rejected proposals. So this idea that he might be able to trade temporary extensions for temporary protected status holders or extend the protections that are currently in place for DACA recipients in exchange for border wall funding, that's something that has already been thrown on the table and rejected by Democrats before. And also, President Trump himself rejected that last year when a DACA for border wall funding proposal was being discussed in the Senate. So they say that this is not, you know, they're not prepared to move forward on this. As we heard from Senator Warner, there are some Democrats who think that this is a good starting point so long as the government is reopened first, and then they might be willing to approach a deal like this. For Republicans, however, they are moving forward with a vote this week. Senator McConnell plans to introduce this bill to the floor this week. Republicans nearly uniformly back it, but it's not going to get a single Democrat.
Okay, so hold your thought there on Senator McConnell, because I want to come back to it. But let's hear a little bit of what the president said this weekend. Again, Gabby, as you noted, he offered 3 years of deportation relief for some immigrants and some changes to asylum rules, but temporary, underscore the word temporary, in return for $5.7 billion for his border wall. And here's a little bit more of what the president said.
The good news is these problems can all be solved, but only if we have the political courage to do what is just and what is right. Both sides in Washington must simply come together, listen to each other, put down their armor, build trust, reach across the aisle, and find solutions.
That's the president from the White House this weekend. And let's listen to a little bit more of how a key Democrat, Senator Mark Warner from Virginia, responded. He was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
What the president proposed yesterday, increasing border security, looking at TPS, looking at the Dreamers, I'll use that as a starting point, but you've got to start by opening the government. What we cannot do, and I've actually had Republicans as well recognize this, is that we cannot reward the kind of behavior of hostage taking, because if the president can arbitrarily shut down the government now, he will do it time and again.
That's Senator Mark Warner on Sunday. Gabby, let me come back to you on the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Mitch McConnell here, because it wasn't, I guess, up until very recently, the past couple of days, the senator was saying that he, you know, wouldn't bring anything to a vote that has that didn't have the president's approval. And I guess, you know, because this is the president's plan, he's willing to bring it to a vote on the Senate floor. But is that going to nudge anything realistically, given that no Democrat's going to support it?
Well, I think the mentality here on behalf of Republicans and the White House, and this includes Leader McConnell, is that if they can get, you know, 50, every single member of the Senate Republican caucus to vote for this, all 53 Republican senators, then at least they can go out there and then show, you know, we've put forward a solution. We've voted for it in the Senate. No Democrats came on board. Democrats aren't willing to negotiate. I mean, that's what we've sort of heard them hint at in the last few days since the president introduced this proposal and since Democrats even preemptively responded to it, saying that we're not going to support this unless the government is reopened. You know, McConnell has sort of been this curious figure throughout all of this because he's very much been behind the scenes, involved in negotiations, but not really speaking publicly about the direction or where things are headed. And meanwhile, insistent, as you said, that there's no utility in even thinking about a solution to the shutdown that doesn't have the president's blessing, that the president wouldn't sign into law if it passed the Senate and the House. So I think this is a move where they're just trying to increase the pressure on Democrats to come to the table, regardless of whether the government is shut down or not.
Well, Gabby Orr covers the White House for Politico, bringing us up to speed on what happened in Washington regarding the shutdown this weekend. Gabby, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so it still has very much the feel of an intractable impasse, this government shutdown. So let us turn now to someone who helped negotiate an end to what was one of the most intractable impasses anywhere in the world. Joining us now from New York is Senator George Mitchell. He was Democratic senator from Maine from 1980 to 1995. He served as Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. And he was the United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland and helped secure the Good Friday Agreement that finally put an end to the Troubles, as they're known, in Northern Ireland in 1998. He was also United States Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from 2009 to 2011. Senator Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So we're 21 years out now from the Good Friday Agreement, and it seems as if it's time for us here in the United States to learn some lessons on how to bring feuding parties to the table. So how would you, I guess my first question to you is, how do you look upon the current impasse in Washington? How would you describe what the fundamentals are that have brought us to this point?
Well, as you noted in the outset, there are politics and principle involved. Most people in public office are driven by two aspirations. One is to solve some problems, to do something with the office that they hold. The second is to get political credit and to satisfy their base of supporters and perhaps expand that base. It's a mixture depending on the individual and the issues. It's very hard to find a solution that is can be a win for everyone. Mm. That is, everyone can say, we did it, when you have only a single issue, build a wall or don't build a wall. In that case, you have ultimately a complete victor and a complete loser. And so I think the way to solve major problems like this, and this is the approach I took in Northern Ireland, was to broaden the base and to include all relevant issues. So if you have a dozen issues on the table, then you can kind of maneuver around and find a solution that everybody can have something that they can go out and say, we prevailed. Mm. So I think a broad discussion on all immigration issues is genuinely relevant. It is true that the system is dysfunctional, but keep in mind that this is a repetition of history. There is no immigration system that can last forever in a society which is changing, growing, in a world which is changing and growing. And you have to view this as an issue that must from time to time be taken up in the light of changing circumstances. So obviously I'm a Democrat, and I think that the idea of opening up the government, passing the appropriations bills that are unrelated to this, and then having a full range of discussion on all of the issues related to immigration, passing a meaningful immigration bill would be a tremendous accomplishment. Right. I don't think that's likely to occur because, of course, the president takes a different view on it. But keep in mind that for people who think, well, it's not possible given the divisions in our country, in 2013, 4 Democrat and 4 Republican senators agreed on comprehensive immigration legislation, mm-hmm. not perfect in anyone's mind, but a reasonable compromise. It got 68 votes in the Senate, substantial numbers of both Democrats and Republicans, but it was not brought up in the House because the Speaker wouldn't bring it up, in part because it would have passed had it come up in the House. There were enough votes to have it, and the Republicans then operated in the House under a rule that said you don't bring a bill up unless a majority of Republicans are for it. Not a majority of the House, but a majority of members of their own party. So precisely because it would have passed with a bipartisan vote, it wasn't brought up.
Right.
If you can now get back to a full negotiation, you might be able to get a bill that attracts enough support from both sides.
Well, Senator Mitchell, we have to take a break here in just a minute. There's so many aspects of what you managed in Northern Ireland that I want to discuss with you as well to learn from. But in just the couple, in the 30 seconds or so before we have to take a break, in hearing all that you just said, though, isn't the implication that we that for any negotiation to be successful, you need two parties who are willing to act in good faith? And do we have that in Washington right now?
Well, that's always difficult. In Northern Ireland, it had the additional factor of tremendous violence and a threat of violence. That was a powerful motivating force for people to get together. That doesn't exist here. But I think there's enough of a basis to proceed in serious negotiation.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about it when we come back from a very quick break. That's Senator George Mitchell. He was Democratic senator from Maine from 1980 to 1995, former Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. And we're talking to him today because he was the United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland. He helped secure the Good Friday Agreement, historic, in 1998. So what lessons does this master negotiator have for us in Washington over the government shutdown now? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Senator George Mitchell. He was the United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland and helped secure the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 that finally put an end to the Troubles, as they're known in Northern Ireland, an historic agreement achieved in 1998. Senator Mitchell, of course, was also Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He's a Democrat, but we are leaning on his experience as a negotiator today to talk about how to reach an agreement to end the government shutdown. And I should also note that, of course, the senator was the United States Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from 2009 to 2011. Senator Mitchell, now, of course, I'm not suggesting at all that the situation in Northern Ireland is the same as what's happening in Washington. In Northern Ireland, we had decades of terrible violence. You could even say centuries, right, depending on your perspective. We had many parties as well, several different governments and different groups at play. But I'm wondering, are there specific things that you managed to do to reach the Good Friday Agreement that might apply at all here over the current shutdown? I mean, if I remember correctly, even I don't want to call it a small thing, but if I remember correctly, you picked a date of Good Friday, 1998, for some kind of agreement to happen. You essentially gave all the parties a deadline, and it worked. I mean, could something like that work here?
Well, the circumstances are not the same in that respect. Yeah. Remember, the deadline was the culmination of several years of negotiation, and it was spiraling to failure. There was an uptick in violence, tit-for-tat assassinations. The talks were collapsing, so it was actually a desperation move on my part. I don't think the same circumstance applies here, but the 800,000 federal workers out of work and not getting paid, I think serve as a not comparable but a relevant deadline for these for the president and for the Democratic leadership. This just can't keep going as it is. When you get into this kind of squabble at this level, I think everyone loses. I think the president is losing support. I think the Democratic leaders are probably losing support. And at some point, members of the public say a pox on both your houses and don't look at the specific details that are being negotiated. So I think there is a pressure for them to move forward. You mentioned earlier in your discussion with the reporter from Politico about Senator McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. He was dealt a serious negative blow a couple of weeks ago when he got the Senate to pass unanimously. Every single senator supported legislation in the belief he thought that the president would sign it. Well, then between the passage and the signing, the president took some flack from members of the more conservative wing of his party. He changed his mind, and so Senator McConnell went into a defensive and really kind of silent mode for a couple of weeks. So I think this now gives him the opportunity to reassert himself, to reinject himself into the process. I think he will present the president's bill, but I think what he's doing, and it's happened historically many times, is he's not just going to present the president's bill. He's going to add to it features that he think will make it difficult for Democrats to vote against it. Relief for hurricanes and other disasters, pick out some in a state of a particular Democrat who may be vulnerable and kind of dare him to vote against that. So I think he'll present a bill loaded with other attractive items to try to get this passed and to take center stage. I don't think it's likely to pass, but it could serve, as Senator Warner suggested, the basis for further negotiation. Right. No matter what anybody says, they have to negotiate at some point, and they have to try to bring this to a close.
Well, so Senator Mitchell, I mean, there's no official mediator right now, but we do have advisors and influential people surrounding the leaders on all sides of this issue. So, I mean, if you were one of those folks, I mean, what would you do? What would you advise to move the process forward? The president did offer, whether Democrats are rejecting it or not, did offer something on the weekend. Is that a slightly opening of the door to pushing negotiations forward?
I think it is. I don't regard it as a serious offer. I mean, think of this. The problem that the president described with the DACA and temporary protective status people was created by the president himself when he sought to discontinue those programs and to place them now in legal limbo. They're in the courts. So what he's essentially saying is, look, I created this problem, but I'll provide temporary relief for it if you'll give me my wall. That's not likely to be an attractive argument to make to someone on the other side. On the other hand, it's a proposal. And as Vice President Pence has suggested, as Senator Warner has suggested, it could be used as a basis for some negotiation going forward. It's tough on the Democrats because they want to stick with the position of no negotiation at all until the government is open. And they may do that for a while, but I think at some point you're going to see at least some form of discussion occurring to try to bring all of this to a close, because it's hurting the country.
Right.
It's hurting the people involved, and it ultimately will hurt the politicians.
Well, so if I may ask Senator Mitchell, how do we get there? Because, I mean, you spent, what, years in Northern Ireland dealing with a number of different parties. And I was watching this tremendous documentary that was produced about 18 years ago called Endgame in Ireland. It's like moment-for-moment analysis of the process that got to the Good Friday Accords. And I was shocked to remember that most of the time, if not all of the time during these discussions, the Sinn Féin and the Ulster Unionists, the British government, they never even looked at each other face to face. Is that right?
Well, the fact is I was there about 5 years, during which I chaired three separate sets of discussions. There were 10 political parties from Northern Ireland, the governments of the United Kingdom and Ireland, and not once ever, never in the 12 years I was there, was I able to get all 12 of them into the same room at the same time. But what I did was I reached out to them. If seven of them came to a meeting, well, then I'd go see the other three in their offices, or I'd call them on the phone and invite them into mine just to try to keep it alive. But I emphasize the difference is this. When people are dying, when bombs are going off, and there are regular assassinations and cruel beatings, it creates an intense public pressure that doesn't exist in a peaceful, hopefully peaceful society like ours. So people may go a little bit longer in holding on to their views in this country. But the fact is, as I said earlier, the damage being done to our society, not just to the millions of individuals involved, but to the economy, to the whole notion of democracy and its functioning, is a real and substantial thing, although difficult to measure and quantify. And I think there is an imperative on all concerned to figure out some way to bring this to a conclusion. And it's not impossible. This is not rocket science. This is people getting together and working out legislation in a democratic and peaceful society.
You know, your point about the specifics of the situation in Northern Ireland is very well taken, Senator Mitchell. I mean, it was people had reached a sort of existential exhaustion there from the difficulties that that Northern Ireland experienced for decades. But that is also, I suppose, why I find what was achieved with the Good Friday Agreement so remarkable, because you had entrenched parties, deeply entrenched, who looked at each other for decades with hatred, right? I mean, and they came to an
agreement. Well, they didn't just look with hatred. They were killing each other.
They were acting out.
They were shooting each other.
And yet
During the negotiations, three of the delegates to the talks were assassinated. Many of the people in the talks had themselves been shot or shot at, or some of them had committed grievous crimes of attempted murder, attempted bombing, had served time in prison. It was a very violent atmosphere and overlay, and that creates a distorting sense to the whole situation that really isn't replicated elsewhere. Interestingly, you have the same, not the same, but a comparable situation in the Middle East, where there continues to be violence, a lot of people killed, and even that has not been enough to bring the parties to the table for the kind of negotiation that can bring it to an end. So while it does serve as a motive for people getting together, and I do want to say, because it should be said, that the real heroes of Northern Ireland were the political leaders of Northern Ireland. They, at great risk to themselves personally, to their families, to their careers, at a moment of crisis, rose to the occasion and took a very dangerous step by entering into this agreement. And it's something that our leadership ought to look at and say, we can do that. We're not threatened with death. We're not being killed or shot at or bombed. But the future of our country is at stake in a different sense.
I suppose that's why the things that each of the parties in Northern Ireland were willing to give up to reach an agreement is what's so remarkable to me, right? Because the IRA gave up its dream of having a united, fully united Ireland. The British government agreed to release from prison people who had been convicted of terrorism, you know, for bombing and murdering people in both the UK and in Northern Ireland itself. So there were sort of core values that ultimately the parties were willing to give up to reach an agreement. It just makes go ahead. I was just going to say, makes me wonder how, like, if there are core values at play here in Washington right now, should people be willing to give those up to reach agreement?
But when we drafted the agreement, it was drafted in a way that everyone would come out of it and not stress the points that you stress, but stress what they gain by the agreement.
Right.
Everybody gains something from the agreement. I myself had been a politician. I was dealing with politicians. Everyone in the talks had been elected to get there. And I understood that I had to present them with something which they could go out and not say, I gave up on prisoners, not say, I gave up on this or that, but say, here's what we gained. And each side had a substantial list of things that they could claim they had achieved, proclaim victory, and go forward together. And that's really what's needed here. You have to figure out a way that you can come up with comprehensive legislation. Look, the president says he's doing this for border security. Well, everybody is for border security. The question is, can you come up with a series of proposals that everyone can come out and say, we've gotten an improved border security? That should not be beyond the capacity of everyone involved. Take just a few examples. The president says that 90% of the heroin coming in from the southern border comes through the southern border and has an adverse effect on Americans. Yes, that's true. But the fact is, almost all of that heroin comes through the legal border crossings
right,
that a wall would have no effect whatsoever on. Well, why couldn't we say that part of border security would be using the most modern technology, and whatever increase in personnel that will help us to detect and interdict those drugs coming in through the legal points of entry? And that's just as much border security as is building a wall out in some desert area to prevent someone from sneaking into the country.
Well, Senator, forgive me for interrupting, but on that point, though, if I could just offer a question. I mean, what makes it – what seems to make it rather difficult is the uniqueness and unpredictability of this particular president, right? Because, I could see an agreement that that includes exactly what you just said. But as the president has proven multiple times last year, he seems very susceptible to the criticisms of, advisors such as Stephen Miller, who want a much harder line on all immigration, or when Ann Coulter throws a bomb over social media. That seems to sway him in a way that makes it impossible to broaden to broaden the terms of negotiation and to reframe it in the way you're talking about.
Yes, but you can describe the same events as the president has repeatedly changed his mind on several aspects of this issue and other issues when presented with evidence that it makes sense to do something else. Let me give you just one other example. There are an estimated 11 million illegal immigrants in the country. They are the subject of a great deal of discussion on all sides. The fact is that a majority of those, better than half, don't come through the southern border, and they don't come illegally. They enter the country legally with visas that are time limited. They stay after the visas expire, so they convert themselves from legal immigrants to illegal immigrants. They come mostly into airports in our country. And we don't have an effective system for tracking them and enforcing the limitations on their visas. That's border security, every much as a wall on our southern border. In fact, it's the principal source of illegal immigrants in the country. An enhanced technological solution to that problem would go a long way toward reducing the population of illegal immigrants in the country, and would be a step that everyone can claim victory on. One of the problems here is that the president, whether deliberately or not, constantly conflates legal and illegal immigration. One of the least publicized parts of his proposals is, that, of course, that he wants to reduce legal immigration.
Right.
Even though the 1 million legal immigrants coming in tend to be not primarily Hispanic from Central America, but Asian. 50% of them are college graduates, substantially higher than the college graduation rate among established Americans. And so we shouldn't be decreasing legal immigration. We should be enhancing it to make sure we get the best people from around the world who contribute so much to our society. I'd like to make one other point, if I could,
sure,
before the next break, because I think it's very important. There's nothing new about any of this. every person in America came here from somewhere else or is derived from people who came here from someone else. 300,000 years ago, humans first appeared on Earth in Africa. It took them a long time to spread around the world. Not until 15,000 years ago did any human set foot in the American continent. They came from Central Asia, people with darker skins, black hair. They spread around. They became the Native Americans. 500 years later, white people came from Europe west across the Atlantic. And since then, there has been discrimination, demonization, controversy over immigration. It's not new. It's as old as our country.
Well, Senator George Mitchell, stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. We're talking with Senator Mitchell, leaning on his experience being the U.S. Special Envoy for peace negotiations in Northern Ireland and also in the Middle East. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to get some insight on possible ways to end the government shutdown. And we're doing so by hearing from Senator George Mitchell. He is Democratic senator from Maine from 1980 to 1995 and, of course, also served as Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. But for this conversation, most importantly, he was United States Special Envoy to Northern Ireland and helped secure the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 that put an end to the Troubles, as they were known, in Northern Ireland. He was also United States Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from 2009 to 2011. And Senator Mitchell, if I may, let me just go to our phones here really quickly and get a couple of calls in. So let's turn to Larry, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm... I'm a little bit to have a guest, Senator Mitchell here with his accomplishments in a very difficult negotiations that really was a life-threatening situation is truly remarkable. And I wonder if he could address the issues that right now, as far as I understand, we don't really have the parties talking at the same table together, as well as these negotiations that they're being called. They're really not negotiations. These are public media utterances. They're not as a result of any true negotiation that's going on. And so I think those should be addressed, that the current climate is not really reflective of that. And I think also the fact that the principal party here, in the form of our president, has shown a disdain for negotiations. He doesn't really negotiate. He more operates via power, I think, and strictly from that, and by fiat. And so his ability or willingness to truly negotiate is very questionable. I think also you have to question now whether or not, if people are in agreement that the government shutdown is not germane to the current situation and it should be ended, then why isn't more pressure being applied to the Republicans in the Senate to override the president's decision and get the government reopened? I think that should be talked about much more, and what the culpability is on Republicans now to undo this logjam, really, that's preventing true negotiations
right
from going forward.
Well, Larry, thank you for your call. Senator Mitchell, let's work backwards from what Larry has said here. First of all, just your response to him saying his suggestion that there should be more pressure put on Republicans to deal with the shutdown first.
Well, Democrats are trying to do that, but the Republican senators, and to a lesser extent, but some degree, the House members are in a tough spot. their base is the president's base. And it's pretty clear that going against the president is very difficult for them politically. They're all embarrassed by the fact that they 100% voted for the legislation just a couple of weeks ago in the belief that the president was going to sign it. And then he reversed himself just a few hours later mm-hmm. when he took some flak from the right wing. So it's a tough spot for them to be in. I agree with much of what Larry said. But the fact is why they're going to bring this bill up tomorrow is to, in effect, turn the tables on that embarrassment of the last couple of weeks and try to put Democrats in the same position. It is true that the president has not been involved much in direct negotiation, but it is also true that Vice President Pence, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and others have been involved in talks. And so I think you're likely to see that accelerating the longer this goes on. And I hope that does happen. I think it has to be brought to a negotiated end. Nationally televised addresses are a form of negotiation, but by themselves insufficient. And I think it will – the public pressure and the loss of support on both sides I think is going to contribute to it coming to an end through negotiation.
Is there also a fundamental lack of trust that's part of the problem here, that progress can't be made for as long as, for all the reasons that you just gave, there isn't a sense that that Democrats feel like they just can't trust the president in his decision making or which way the wind might blow next? And if so, how do you build trust between the groups?
Well, that is a central problem. I said many times that in Northern Ireland, in the Middle East and elsewhere, lack of trust, indeed active mistrust, mm-hmm. is the central contributor to the problem, because if you don't believe anything the other side says, it's very hard to take action on it. I overcame that in Northern Ireland by setting out a deeply detailed series of steps to be taken by all sides, negotiated in advance in private before they were taken in public. So that it eliminated the need for trust other than that they would keep the word of what they agreed to, which they did. But I think that's a huge factor. And it's a big problem for Democrats negotiating the fact that the president does repeatedly change his mind, as he demonstrated on this very issue just a couple of weeks ago. Nonetheless, he is the president. There is an issue. There is a problem. It must be solved, and therefore negotiations must take place, although not in optimal conditions. You have to deal with the reality as it exists, not as you wish it were.
We've spoken a lot about President Trump here, but if you were – say there were a mediator between Republicans and Democrats right now, what would you tell House Speaker Nancy Pelosi? What would you advise her?
Well, I think Speaker Pelosi has chosen what I believe to be the proper course, and that is to enact all of the appropriations legislation that is unrelated to border and border security and allow the government to go forward. To me, that makes clear sense. The president has has rejected that, although she's going to enact, according to the press, the appropriations bills in the House that the Republicans in the Senate themselves approved just a short time ago. It's one reason why they're desperate to get their own bill up there to look like they're taking action, because they're embarrassed by the fact that the bills that they passed are now unacceptable to the president in this current impasse. I do think that Nancy, who is a friend and someone I like and respect, is ultimately going to have to recognize, as will Chuck Schumer, that at some point there has to be a negotiation no matter the circumstances. And I think they're going to recognize that it can be done at different levels. Much of the negotiation that I did in Northern Ireland was in private mm-hmm. and in some cases in complete secrecy. And you don't do everything in public through televised appearances. And I think that has to happen at some point in whatever circumstances exist to bring about an opening of the government and then a negotiation over the very serious issues that we face on immigration.
So that's a really interesting point. And I'm wondering, how do we get to that point where there are substantive talks in private? Because so much, and in fact, our caller was hinting to this as well. He was basically saying that so much of this is happening in the public sphere, through the media, through social media, through moments where, I mean, as you know, Senator Mitchell, when Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were sitting in the Oval Office and the president invited the White House press pool in. I mean, is there a way to get beyond the highly public nature of the sniping that we're seeing going on?
One of the great challenges that I faced in Northern Ireland and the Middle East, and which our leaders face today, is the competition of values between the public right to know, conducting public business in public, and the necessity that some discussions and negotiations must occur in private and in secrecy. It's very hard to do it, particularly in a country like ours where we have an open system, social media. Everybody's a reporter. Everybody's got a camera to take your picture wherever you are, record what you're saying, wants to know what you said 3 minutes ago. And yet some negotiations have to occur in private and in secrecy. That's the only way this can function. It's a tremendous challenge. There's a tension between the two. I faced it often when I was Senate Majority Leader and when I served in Northern Ireland and the Middle East. But you have to accept the reality that not every bit of governing must occur in public for everyone to see. And it's important that the leaders preserve the right and act on it to do some discussion in complete privacy and secrecy, if nothing else, to lay the foundation for an ultimate agreement.
Well, let's go to Margaret, who's calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I would agree with the previous caller. And what I would like to see happen is we do have bipartisan, unlike Ireland, we have bipartisan support for the bills that have been put through. And so I think the people holding this up right now are Senator McConnell and the president. So I would like to see the Senate put through the bills that were given to them, send them off to the White House, not create a new bill that's going to create new angst. Let's send the things that everybody agreed on before to the White House. If Mr. Trump chooses not to sign them, I believe the Senate could override this. I will tell you that in Kentucky, although it's not making it on the news, many of Mr. Senator McConnell's people are already trying to get a hold of him to say open the government. Mm. He could be the hero in this. So could the Senate.
Right.
So I would like to see the original, the budget that was agreed upon by all of them. The only person holding it up then is Mr. Trump for a wall he promised we wouldn't pay for. We can't afford that wall, and most people don't want it.
Right.
Thank you for taking my call.
Margaret, thank you for your call.
Well, I would like to see that. But the reality is it's not going to happen. Senator McConnell is not going to present that same bill again. The Republican senators are not going to present that same bill again. A large part of the reason why he's going to offer this other bill is to, in effect, move away from or shake off the legacy of the bill that they passed 2 weeks ago. So while I agree it's a desirable outcome, I think it's a very unlikely outcome, and you have to deal with the reality that the bill they're going to present will represent the president's offer plus whatever sweeteners they can put in, whatever issues they could put in to try to attract enough Democratic senators to enact it. I don't think they'll succeed in that, although it will be an uncomfortable vote for many Democrats.
Senator Mitchell, I'm still thinking about what you said in the beginning of our conversation, that a step towards a successful negotiation is to broaden the issues away from, you know, the single win-loss issue of the wall, right? To talk more holistically about immigration. But, you know, as you noted, we saw that. We went through a couple of negotiations last year that did exactly that. But those ultimately were undermined by the very hard line on legal immigration, for example, that some of the president's advisors are really pushing. So haven't we also already encountered, you know, the pitfalls of widening the terms of negotiation too far?
one of the cardinal principles of negotiating difficult issues is you don't take the first no as the last answer
yes.
or the seventh no or the 17th no. In Northern Ireland, I'm fond of saying, we had 700 days of failure and one day of success. Over a period of years, almost every day, I was asked by one or more reporters, when are you leaving? You have failed to get an agreement. And when are you going back to the United States? And they were right. Up until that moment, we had failed to get an agreement, and we didn't get it until the very last, the 700th day. Persistence, patience, determination is absolutely essential in these circumstances. And you're absolutely right. We didn't. The efforts were made. They failed. What we have to do is learn from those failures and try again.
Senator Mitchell, I have to say, what you just said is the most hopeful and uplifting thing I've heard about this shutdown in many, many weeks. That to remind us that 700 no's are just what presages the one key yes. Incredible. Let's just get one more call in here. Sean is calling from Decatur, Illinois. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi. How's it going today?
Very well, or sort of, I guess, relatively well. But Sean, what's your thought, quickly?
Well, my question was, is if President Trump decides to use the government emergency assistance to, call it as a crisis in order to enforce his proposal on the wall, then why would he hold the American people hostage? I'm just a small-town state worker, and I'm losing my benefits because of it.
Sean, thank you for your call.
I believe the reason that the president has hesitated to call this a national emergency and exercise unilateral power is that Republicans greatly fear the precedent this would set for the future. They're well aware that at some point in the future, possibly as soon as 2021, there will be a Democratic president. And for the members of the legislative branch now, the senators, the leadership on both sides, to surrender the independence and authority of the legislative branch of our government, to say that a president can declare an emergency in any time under any circumstances and act as he wishes. I think first it would be obviously challenged in court. It would be a difficult court battle because there are a lot of competing values here. But I think Republicans who generally fear and oppose and have made public careers out of opposition to government authority are quite reluctant, and thankfully so, for what would be, I believe, an inappropriate use of executive authority and an expansion of presidential power that could come back to haunt them and the country in the future.
Senator, we have just a minute left to go, and there's one last question about Northern Ireland that I wanted to ask you, because I don't know if you saw this. In the last 24 hours, there was some reporting out of the UK that Prime Minister Theresa May, this has to do with Brexit, floated a trial balloon about adjusting the Good Friday Agreement in order to get Brexit through. They've vehemently denied it since then, but just your view on Northern Ireland and the UK now, you just got 30 seconds or so to go here.
Well, it's hard. I believe Brexit was a mistake, and it could cause enormous problems in Northern Ireland and certainly in the Republic of Ireland if it goes through. I hope very much that time remains for them to take an action that would permit the United Kingdom to remain in some separate status. They've done it for Norway, for Switzerland, for other countries. There's no reason why they can't do it for the UK, and that remains, in my hope, the outcome with no change in the current status of the border in Northern Ireland.
Well, Senator George Mitchell, Democratic Senator from Maine from 1980 to 1995 and Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. And of course, he was the United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland, helped secure the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. He was also the United States Special Envoy for Middle East Peace from 2009 to 2011. Senator Mitchell, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.